You're listening to the News Project Podcast for the week of September 20th, 2021, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Housing, fixing the shortage, Richville Road solar project turned down, and Climate Council hears from the locals.
Housing, or more frequently the lack of it, has been a hot topic locally and statewide for a while now, way before the COVID pandemic prompted a wave of new Vermonters to seek homes and places to live here. Land prices, labor costs, and material costs are frequently cited as factors as to why potential developers find that building affordable or workforce housing simply doesn't pencil out, as the expression goes. They are too expensive to build for what the market will bear. Other factors are in play as well, such as local zoning rules and obtaining needed permits. To try and understand the problem behind why the supply can't meet the clear demand, we talked with a group of people in the housing field on what drives up costs and what some solutions might be.
Because of land costs and utility costs, which present some great upfront costs to developers to provide housing, particularly when you're talking about multiple units at one location. The state has substantial programs and the area participates in program when you talk about rental housing and subsidized rental housing. But once we get above those income levels, and this is our problem in my from my perspective, is we don't have anything above those income levels, and which are relatively low because from my perspective at least in today's conditions. And also we don't have anything for ownership. So when people want to get into ownership, either you can have the financial wherewithal to do it, or you're left out in the dark. So the town can contribute, of course, and the state is now starting to promote this policy, is to increase density in certain desirable areas so that the cost of land per housing unit goes down. And I'm testing that principle on Route 7A, where recently that was upgraded to 10 units per acre from one or two, 2 units per acre. So that's a help. For example, I had to buy a parcel of land there for, just under $400,000. And if I had to put and it was 3 usable acres. Well, under the old zoning, I could do, 5 units. So you can see the difference there just in the cost of land. And now I can do up to 30 units. So that makes a big difference there. Then the other related costs is the infrastructure to support housing, sewer, water, electrical, and all those utilities. Our town policy, and it's probably generally more or less statewide, is that a developer is required to pay for those costs. So I have to put in a private road into that 3 acres. I have to put in the electrical. And to be honest, we're going underground because long term we just think that's a better posture. We have to provide our own water off of town water, which is on 7A, so it makes it relatively convenient. I think I had to put in my own road, and then we have to provide sewer, and the option there was to do the septic field, a large community-owned septic field, but now I think we're going to head to town sewer hookup because the town is proposing to run sewer up 7A now. But either way, the developer, or myself in this case, has to front all those costs. And for the 20 units we're proposing there, by the time it's all said and done, it's $1 million, give or take, if not more. It takes a lot of upfront cost to invest in housing before you even start about building a house, okay? Then you go from there And on top of that, you have to go through all the permits. And for the most part, the town was very, I don't want to say easy to deal with, but very fair to deal with. Act 250 got to be a problem again, and particularly there because there's duplication of effort. And that's an area that needs to be reviewed in justice.
I think the affordable housing has more or less gone out of the picture since COVID started because, the supply and demand of the materials drove up so high. Everybody wanted to build, which drove the suppliers up. COVID hit, they weren't able to keep up with the demand for everything, so it just drove the price up. Our lead times are down, or our extended way out, so, we might have 9 or 10 week lead times on windows, so scheduling things has just been a total nightmare. Try to schedule things in a timely manner to make sure that each phase of the project is moving accordingly. And then I'd also say that as far as the labor goes, our prices for the labor have gone up. The cost of living for everybody has gone up. So the pay rate has to go up. Also, there's so much work to do. There's a high demand for these guys. So they kind of have more of a, they've got more of a one up on the employer because they can say, oh, well, so-and-so is going to offer me more money. So then you have to offer them more money to keep them. So labor and materials have both gone up. So affordable housing has kind of gone out the window as, it's towards most of these higher end clients that are moving out of the cities and doing the work. And then a lot of the locals are realizing that that drove the price of the housing up so high, they're selling, and then now they're out renting without the ability to buy again. So the market has just, it is super unpredictable. It's like it's never been, and it's a hard time. You're busier than ever, but it's so hard to get work accomplished the way that we used to. We used to be able to, when things were more readily available as far as, materials, labor, we were able to do it for a cheaper cost, which gave more people the ability to build.
John O'Keefe, the town manager of Manchester, discussed some of the zoning and utility components involved in addressing the housing shortage.
I think there's been some marginal improvements. The biggest thing that we've done is we've updated all of our zoning to encourage workforce housing. There's very specific incentives to encourage more development around the downtown areas. So I think the zoning piece is there. I don't feel like the town zoning is standing in the way. There's this big giant elephant called Act 250 that continues to plague housing in Vermont, but any development really. But housing, and I mean, we're seeing people that have properties that could be developed into more housing, but they're actually developing less housing there because they don't want to get into Act 250. So that's really too bad. And then the other piece I think that that the town needs to work on is, and we're working on it on Richville Road and on Main Street, is in order to provide more housing, you really have to provide more density. And one way to provide more density is the zoning, but it's also water and sewer. So both of those roadways have water. They don't have sewer all the way down them. And I think that, right now we're looking at first up Main Street because there's a lot of property there that could be converted into workforce housing. And then the other piece is, we're doing a study on it right now, is to get sewer down Richville Road, at least down to the property that the town owns at Airport Road, and then with a possibility of going up to Cass Terrace. But those are the big pieces that I think the town really controls, is really in the driver's seat, is utilities and zoning.
A housing summit planned for October 13th in Arlington will bring together many people in the housing industry to discuss these and other related issues. State Representatives Kathleen James and Seth Bongartz are organizing the housing summit, and we had the chance to discuss with them why this was an area they felt it was important to focus on.
In the end, affordable housing is going to get built because of local leadership. The state can help make funds available, but it really requires local leadership to help make it happen. And part of that local leadership is looking at, for instance, zoning regs, and really trying to make it much easier to build denser housing in downtowns or toward downtowns, and especially where there are services available like sewer and water. And by the way, we put a lot of money into sewer and water as well, which then in turn helps make it possible. That's another ingredient, often another ingredient for building affordable housing if you have the hookups, the ability to hook up to town, sewer and water especially. But it really requires local leadership. And then the state helping make the resources available for the local leadership to then take and help make something happen. But zoning, for instance, and S101 was a grant program. I believe that will pass. It just didn't quite make it out of conference in time at the end of the session, at the very end. But it provides grant money for towns to work on, to help fund regional the cost of the town to hire the regional commission to help them change their zoning regs to make it easier to do infill development. And that's where, and especially because people want and need services to be walking distance to services as much as possible. So that kind of leadership from towns identifying places where affordable housing might take place and then helping pull together the people to help make it happen, that kind of thing. But now to actually have the resources available to do it is a sea change.
I think, one thing I just wanted to toss this out there because I love talking about this, but when you talk about the importance of zoning, one of the ideas that I've been fascinated by is the concept of tiny house communities, which are springing up all over the country, as ways to either house the homeless or provide low-income housing or target other communities. And one of the first things I did was reach out to find out, for example, in Manchester, is there anything in our zoning that would preclude a tiny house development? And there's not, which is great news. So, if you think about a 4-acre parcel, that you could maybe fit 10 to 15 houses on. They're arrayed around a community building with a kitchen and a little rec room and a garden. And you could try to find a developer. And I'd love to try to make this happen in Manchester or Arlington or Sunderland or any place where we can find the right parcel. It would be really amazing to find a developer to do a pilot project and see if we can get a tiny house community going. I think it'd be a great place for seniors to live. It would be a great place for young working couples or single folks, or you could use it as low-income housing.
And tiny housing doesn't have to mean the truly tiny.
It could 400 square feet.
It could be a little bit bigger than, yeah.
I was wondering if there's a definition of a tiny house. 400 square
feet. They can be really tiny.
They can be really tiny.
Look at Lord Dillon's room. I just wanted $150 million in ARPA money. I mean, how's that going to be divvied up around the state? I mean, is there going to be a certain amount allocated to each county, or how is that going to work? And I guess leading to the question of, will any of that money find its way down here to help?
This is where the local leadership comes in, because to the extent that the money is going through VHCB, it's a grant program. You put together a proposal and you apply for it, and it competes with others. The money comes, but there's no reason in the world it can't come down here.
I reached out to VHCB in anticipation of this conversation and asked that exact question. And this is where we really need to make sure that our local leaders, know about and are actively applying for these grants. They said they know of a couple grant applications that are in the works for this next round of money, which is really great. But, we should be actively and sort of aggressively applying for those grant programs for projects here in our communities.
One of the speakers at the Housing Summit in Arlington will be Josh Hanford, the state's Commissioner of Housing and Community Development. We talked with him a few weeks ago about some of the issues in play with housing.
The last decade that we were building more units was in the 80s. We were building like 3% above the replacement loss at that point. Now we're at 0.018%. Like, we're barely replacing the units that are lost. And to further exacerbate the problem, family sizes and structures have all changed during that during that period. We have smaller households, which means, there's less income earners coming in to afford the housing they need. And most of the housing we have in Vermont was built before 1929. So, and what did we build before then? Large homes that were meant for large families. And so we've suffered from this for decades. We're behind the eight ball here for a couple decades in our housing problem. And it's really hit this crisis point, you know, really highlighted by the pandemic, because we wanted everyone housed safely and not in congregate settings, you know, where we typically house folks that are struggling with, you know, homelessness, finding a place to live. There was shelters, but we sort of moved them out and needed to find individual housing for everyone that wasn't in an existing housing, you know, a household. And so that really shined the light. Well, wait a second. Why do we have 2,500 people in hotels and motels? That means we're that short on units. Just forget about the ability to even pay. We have the money to pay for them. We just don't even have that many units. And so it really is a long road to get to this point. And the problem with building new housing to get ourselves out of it is this sort of missing middle, the workforce housing, is especially hard to build, because we have lots of federal programs, state programs that focus on the lower income affordable housing with the big A. And we have a great network to do that across the state. We have lots of partners, Vermont Housing Conservation Board, Vermont Housing Finance Agency. We have local partners like in your region, Shires Housing, NeighborWorks of Western Vermont, and they work on those issues in the way that they're able to provide affordable housing at rents that people can afford. Is they build these properties debt free. They get all the funding to build those units without taking on any debt. It comes in the form of tax credits and grants and so forth. So they can produce a nice new apartment complex on the scene, and they can offer rents that are affordable to the region. It costs $400,000 to build a modest home, and there's no subsidies or programs to sort of help people build homes that are above what they sort of define as affordable housing, which is 80% of the area median income and below. So folks between that 80% up to 150% of area median income, those are the folks that have the hardest time finding a place to live right now, because they've been priced out. Rental properties aren't being built in that zone, and home ownership units are being built at price points above that bracket as well. And so we really have to, as local government, state government, federal government, sort of break down the barriers and the things that get in the way of building that kind of housing.
He stressed the connection between workforce housing and a workforce. Without a place to live, it's hard to attract often badly needed workers to move here.
In all of our communities, and need to have tough discussions with our neighbors that you're going to need to welcome an apartment building in your neighborhood. You know, if you're going to be out talking about, you know, we need workers, you know, there's no one to staff the hospital, and, you know, we need diversity, and we need to welcome affordable housing into our neighborhoods and be honest with ourselves about that, and have housing commissions and change our zoning. And then at the state level, we need to provide incentives so that our own environmental and land use protection laws don't become a barrier to building the housing we need. Because what happens is it doesn't stop. The development just goes farther up the dirt road and it becomes a one McMansion rather than five units of housing in an infill site in downtown, because that $50,000 Act 250 fee was enough to make that project no longer cost effective.
The Arlington Summit, to be held at the former Catholic Church in Arlington, which is becoming part of a new community center known as Arlington Common, will be held Wednesday, October 13th. For more information, you can visit the Bennington County Regional Commission's website at bcrcvt.org. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. A proposal to place a 500-kilowatt solar installation consisting of about 2,000 panels on a field alongside part of Richville Road near Bourne Brook in Manchester has been denied by the state's Public Utility Commission. The project would have had an, quote, undue adverse effect on aesthetics, unquote, the commission decided, adding that they believed an average person observing the project from the homes on Richville Road would find this unscreened view offensive because of the project's proximity to the road and homes and because of the project's scale in relation to its setting next to the entrance to a residential neighborhood. That factor overrode other considerations such as public health and safety, waste disposal, and transportation, among others, although other concerns about possible flooding were also noted. The project had been under development by Manchester-based MHG Solar, but had drawn much opposition from local residents who contended their views of Mount Equinox would have been impacted, despite a plan to screen off the panels by planting trees. Thomas Hand was the developer who had hoped to build the project. He said he does not plan to appeal the decision, and after 2 years of working on the Richville project, it was time to move on.
I don't think we'll appeal. I mean, there's not really any new evidence, right? It kind of just comes down to aesthetics, right? And the PUC has said, you know, the Planning Commission Select Board approval, the, you know, Regional Planning Commission approval, Department of Public Service saying it's not a problem, our aesthetic experts saying it's not a problem, is overweighed by, you know, a handful of neighbors that say that it is a problem aesthetically. So, you know, I don't know. I don't really see any value in appealing it to the exact same body that just denied it. Right. You know, I mean, it's sort of the unfortunate thing with this PUC decision. You know, they're using a lot of the language from the town and the regional plan, saying that Equinox is a scenic resource that needs to be protected. And, you know, as you know, there's almost nowhere you can be in Manchester where Equinox isn't going to be a backdrop to, you know, if you're looking up at the skyline. So I don't know. It's not entirely clear to me given this PUC ruling, really what makes a good site, you know, aside from being totally invisible, which is, there just aren't very many of those.
Many of the neighboring homeowners on the other side of Richville Road were pleased with the decision. Tim Boucher is one of the residents who opposed the project, and he gave us his reaction to the Utility Commission's decision.
Yes, us and all the neighbors, my wife and I, Dodie and I, and the neighbors, we are all very happy for that the Epoch's decision was to deny the project based on aesthetics and the area where it is. Basically, it's more of a residential neighborhood, and you know, right across the street from our homes, we didn't feel that was the right place. We aren't against solar energy by any means, but there is a place for them, and we felt in our neighborhood, right in our front yard, it's not where we want it. So it was good that the EPUC came down and visited, did a site inspection a second time, because it gave them more of a feel for the neighborhood and the aesthetics of where the solar field was going to be.
And you felt that the plan to plant trees along the roadside there to kind of block the view, that was not adequate?
Well, I think they kind of said that, you know, they were going to put plantings in there, but they would mature within 5 to 10 years. You know, and mature 5 to 10 years, you're still going to have to visualize that for the next 5 years. So that was our biggest concern also, is they, and then who would maintain it and keep it up to date to make sure if the trees die, we're going to replace them or not replace them. So that was one of the other reasonings why.
Thomas Hand noted that Vermont's ambitious goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% from levels recorded in 1990 by the year 2050 will be hard to meet if projects like the ones proposed for Richville Road won't pass muster.
Vermont has a problem here in the sense that if a handful of folks can derail even a small project that's going to generate some portion of a town's or a state's needs, then we're never going to hit the goals, right? So Manchester, you know, 2.5%, you can do the math. That means you need about 40 of these to meet Manchester's total goals. So, you know, 100 to 150 acres worth of panels. Now, if a handful of neighbors can say, well, I don't like to look at it, and the PUC decides that that's grounds for blocking it, how are you ever going to build 100 or 150 acres of solar panels in the Manchester area?
An even earlier deadline is looming. The Global Warming Solutions Act, passed last year by the state legislature, calls for greenhouse gas emissions to be 26% lower than levels recorded in 2005 and 40% lower than those posted in 1990 by the year 2030. The state's Climate Council held a public meeting at Emerald Lake in East Dorset on September 22nd to solicit input on how to reach those goals. We'll have a separate report in that meeting for you to watch shortly. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The first of several deadlines designed to lower Vermont's output of climate pollution is looming in the not-too-distant future. Under the Global Warming Solutions Act passed by the state legislature last year, the state is mandated to reduce greenhouse gas pollution by 26% below 2005 levels by the year 2025, only a little more than 3 years away. Then, the next target is to reduce them by 40% below 1990 levels by the year 2030, and 80% below 1990 levels by the year 2050. To do that, the state needs to reduce its use of fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal, for example, in sectors like transportation, heating, and agriculture. But first, under the Global Warming Solutions Act, a climate action plan needs to be developed by December 1st of this year to chart the course by how those goals are to be achieved. A 23-member Vermont Climate Council was established by the Vermont legislature. They're responsible for drafting the climate action plan due by December 1st. The Vermont Agency of Natural Resources is supporting the work of the Climate Council, which includes gathering input from Vermonters to inform the action plan. This week saw the start of a series of meetings the Climate Council is holding across the state to solicit input from state citizens on the building blocks of the plan to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, a major factor in climate change and global warming. The second of these meetings was held Wednesday, September 22nd, at Emerald Lake in East Dorset, and drew a large crowd that filled a pavilion there. Jane Lazorchak, the project director for the Global Warming Solutions Act, gave the initial overview of the meeting.
So if it doesn't seem like a lot, it's an unbelievable endeavor. We're trying to get at not only what are the buckets of work that we need to do to meet these ambitious requirements, but the how, all within 13 months. And so we're marching full steam ahead at this point to the adoption of a climate action plan on December 1st. You are all here at a really critical time in the process. We're really excited to hear from you about your ideas, about actions, about how we can make these solutions real for Vermonters on the ground. So we really welcome you into this dialogue. This is the second tonight, but what we hope will be a long partnership with Vermonters in thinking about how we co-create climate solutions that work for all of us. We also have a unique moment in time in that this climate action plan is aligned with the same time that the state, the Public Service Department, is working towards an update on the Comprehensive Energy Plan. It's not their first time, so we're working really closely with them, but we want these two plans to be aligned where there's overlap, speak to each other, and reference each other, really in the energy policy space. And so it's a really been an amazing partnership at the state government level and all across, with all hands on deck thinking about solutions that work for Vermonters in this space.
Those attending the meeting then broke up into small groups and discussed two main questions. What climate impacts are you most concerned about, and why? And two, how have you been personally affected? Those conversations consumed the bulk of the two-hour-long gathering and were followed by each group reporting out on their discussions and suggestions.
Three priorities we identified. First of all, renewable transportation incentives, so making EVs and public transportation more available and affordable. Second, waste and consumption reduction, so closing resource loops through recycling and composting and recycling adjacent processes. Three, thoughtful and equitable management of human needs, so agriculture, housing, and water being managed in a manner which is aware of natural and human ecosystems.
Thank you.
This material will be processed by the council as they develop the action plan due by December 1st. Afterwards, we had the chance to talk to a few of the participants to find out what their reactions and takeaways were from the meeting.
I was impressed by the turnout and the ideas that people, you know, had brought with them, some of which were already in the plan, it seems, or in the in sort of the pre-draft. Overall, it was really encouraging, I think, just to hear the passion and the often very thoughtful. Is this practical? What are the limitations? Those kinds of conversations.
Well, I was surprised by the different kinds of comments. I thought it'd be more directed towards specifically what we'd have to do to reduce our energy needs, and I was like electric cars and exactly what we would have to do. And I heard all sorts of things like community. It's so important. We want to make our own decisions. It was interesting. Very interesting.
You know, I come to a lot of these and I've done a lot of Zooms with them, and each time I'm amazed at the number of ideas, the innovation, the intelligence, the passion. So, not only do you get good information, new information, you also get energized all over again, no pun intended, to, take on the challenge that we have. And one of the big things our group talked about was getting more incentives for transportation, more state tax incentives, more federal tax incentives, and dealerships to start doing more, to bring the price down of e-vehicles so that anyone can afford them. That's what we're going to have to do. It's going to have to be a major push, and we don't have a lot of time.
We also got to check in with Jane Lazorchak, the project director for the Global Warming Solutions Act, for her take on the meeting.
It felt like an all actions approach was needed at the table that I listened into, a recognition that it's been a long time coming and that we really need to focus our energies in almost all of the above actions being proposed. Our table spoke a lot about equity, efficiency, and in the building sector. I was heartened to see people talk about climate migration not only as the challenges, but also as an opportunity to push forward ideas of clustered housing, new housing development. There was lots of support for TCI, the Transportation Conservation Initiative, and participation in that. So it felt energizing and reinforcing. I will say there was also a recognition of making sure that our switches don't outsource our issues and emissions. And so a recognition that while we need to make the change fast, that making the right change is an appropriate thing. So to be thoughtful in the solutions and actions that we put forward.
After a similar meeting planned for Island Pond the next night, there will be an online public engagement event held on September 30th. More information about this and other activities of the Climate Council can be found at their website, climatechange.vermont.gov. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.